So, Dave, I've got to share this with you. One father to another. I had an amazing I had an amazing moment driving in the car with my 16-year-old, soon to be in just a few days, my 17-year-old. We're talking, and he's watching the Historical Roasts series on Netflix. Have you seen this?
I have not. No, this is the comedian, what's his name? But go ahead.
Yeah, Jeff Ross.
That's right. Yeah.
Quote unquote, the roast master general. And he had a nice little series on Netflix called Bumping Mics, where they were just doing roast humor, him and another comedian whose name is escaping me right now. But so he's got another series in which they have actors and actresses dress up as historical figures, and they do a roast based on that concept. Like the first one was Abraham Lincoln, and the different people were roasting him, included like Mary Todd Lincoln, Harriet Tubman, and John Wilkes Booth.
Oh, that's fun. All right.
Yeah. And they're all in full costume. It's kind of neat. So he was talking about this, and I was saying, you know, Jeff Ross is an interesting case study in entertainment. I remember him as a struggling stand-up comedian that would get bit parts in movies back in the 80s, and he just never broke through. He was a good comedian, solid stand-up work. He just, for one reason or another, just never seemed to break through.
Right.
And then Comedy Central resurrects the Fryer roast concept, and he gets on screen and he's really good at roast humor, really good at that kind of insult comedy. And now today he's got clearly some kind of a multi-series deal with Netflix where he's developing these different ideas. And I said, it just goes to show you, Alex, I said, it's like I say on the podcast all the time, you don't get to choose what you're good at. And Alex kind of sat back and thought for a while, and he says, yeah, but you're also the same guy that says there's no such thing as talent, and those two ideas don't go together.
Oh, zippity-doo, look at this.
The good news is I've successfully raised an analytic thinker.
Good.
Like, he was thinking critically about this. And, I mean, also just it's so often when you've got kids, you feel like you're talking to the wall. You know, you don't know what's sinking in and what's not. And clearly, some of the stuff that I've been saying has been sinking in with this kid. It's a delight.
Brad, you know you've raised a child well when they throw back Socratic questioning at you. They're like, well, that may be, father, but why? What about this? Like, stop using Socrates against me.
Yeah. The Socratic method also, wasn't that where you told somebody a fact and then slapped them in the face so that they would remember it? I think that was Socratic method as well.
I think Socratic method, Brad, was if you ever lost an argument, you had to take a bit of poison. I think that's what it was.
And I was very close to having to sip the hemlock tea, as it were, as I was driving him to practice, because he was right. And I'm like, oh.
By the way, I hate to pause you, but wouldn't it be a funny little bit if someone gives Socrates the hemlock tea and he's like, you're a little heavy on the hemlock, and then just drops dead.
I much preferred this when it was called Smooth Move.
This is a smooth move right to the grave.
Wouldn't that be great if you give her if you give Socrates the hemlock tea and he goes, what, no cream and sugar?
What, I can't go out in style? All right. This is not even the good china. What?
Well, yeah, you're just going to drop it.
You're just going to drop it, Grandpa. All right, easy there. Just because I'm about to die doesn't mean I can't have a nice cup with a little cream and sugar.
It always amazed me. Once I found out that hemlock was a poison, that was the name on Sesame Street of the Sherlock Holmes character. It was Sherlock Hemlock. Do you remember that?
Oh, my. That's funny. That's good writing. Sherlock Hemlock.
Yeah. But I never noticed it was a poison before.
That name also keeps the Arthur Conan Doyle estate away from you, like, in terms of lawsuits.
Yes. And but so basically, they picked their poison.
Brad Geiger. Let's go out on a big note. This has been Comic Lab. You've been listening to Brad
Good
Geiger.
Good night, everybody. But before we close it out, it forced me to rethink and because I, both of those concepts I believe in really strongly.
Right. Because you're also a big proponent that you can't get worse at something that you do every day, which is another way to look at this same problem.
Right. Right. And I want to hold on to those. So it forced me to kind of rethink how I'm phrasing that. So basically, and I'm putting this out there because I know he listens to the podcast too, and he'll catch me in another fallacy if I present one. But I'm sticking with my guns. There's no such thing as skill. Which is an overstatement. I'm sure there is a certain degree of skill. Certain things you're born with, better hand-eye coordination or something like that. I get that. But I very strongly am a proponent of talent and thinking of your abilities as skill rather than thinking about it as talent, because talent is finite. Talent is something you're born with. It's finite. Skill is something that's infinite. It's something that you can practice and get better and better and better at. So I like that idea. I value that. So that's staying. So I think a better way to parse that other one is not to say you don't get to pick what you're good at, but you don't get to pick what you are known for, or you don't get to pick what people like from you, right? Because in both cases, Jeff Ross is a good comedian and he worked hard to become a good comedian. He worked hard at that specific type of comedy when he realized that people were really responding to that roast humor. You don't get to pick what people like out of you, or what people, better yet, respond to out of you. You don't get to pick that. You just get to be happy that it happened. What do you think about that as rephrasing that whole idea?
Yeah, I think the last time we had this topic come up about skill versus talent versus hard work versus naturally gifts that were given to you kind of a thing. My comparison was to the NBA, the National Basketball Association, because I always think about how, sure, Charles Barkley was 6'6", right? A gigantic human being, and also built like a brick house and strong as anything, right? But Spud Webb was 5'7", and yet through incredible hard work and stick-to-itiveness, was also a talented NBA player. Not as world-changing as Barkley. But what I'm getting at is you can be born with a certain skill set, a natural skill set, i.e. Charles Barkley being 6'6". Or you could be born 5'7", Spud Webb. But regardless, both of those can be improved by stick-to-itiveness, by hard work, by practice, by sticking to your guns, and by honing your skills, right? I think it's a dance of both what you're naturally given, but also you can do incredible work over the course of 10 or 15 years by just stick-to-itiveness and hard work, right? So that's my counterpoint to that idea.
I agree. Absolutely. And just wait, having spent a little bit of time with your kids, they are both very smart kids. And this moment is coming for you too, my friend.
Oh, it's already started to happen, Brad. It's already started to happen. I've already been handed my hemlock tea and said, time for you to sit down, father. Well, on that note, my friend, I'm going to say hello and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave! Let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. I had a topic I wanted to bring up with you because I stumbled upon a concept in the New York Times this past week. And it is actually something that you and I have talked about a lot, but it's been given a coined phrase and a good descriptor. And I thought we should revisit it just for a second.
Sounds good to me.
So something you and I have talked about in the past, Brad, is I always thought, boy, when I win an award, then I'll know that I have made it as a cartoonist and everything's fine and I'm happy and content, right?
Yeah.
Well, here we go. I win a Silver Ruben Award from the National Cartoonist Society. All right, great. That's going up in the studio. Oh boy, the first day in the studio, I'm at my drawing desk, and oh boy, Brad, my eyes keep flitting over to the award. Oh, how lovely. Oh, Brad, I've made it now. Now I have an award.
Basking in the glow of that nice little
Brad,
plaque.
Oh, Brad, it's lovely. Yes. Oh, my gosh. Cut to 1 week later. Couldn't care less. Didn't make that big of an impact on my life.
Right.
Back to being my own self and thinking that I have all these problems and insecurities and faults and failures. And so whatever flitting lift that award got me, I returned back to my normal set, because ultimately we are who we are. And the self-love that you can generate doesn't come from an external. It comes from yourself, right?
Yeah.
And so we've talked about that before on the show, whether that's, boy, Brad, as soon as I can make $50,000 for my cartooning, that'll be great.
Yeah.
As soon as I make $100,000 for my cartooning, that'll be great. As soon as I've won an award, as soon as I have an employee, as soon as I move to New York, as soon as I, whatever it is for you.
Yeah.
The idea that once you get there, that will be the shining moment that'll let you, that will open up the gates and everything will be great. Right, Brad?
Absolutely. And it doesn't happen, right?
It doesn't happen. And so I was reading an article this week, apparently a psychologist, sociologist named Dr. Ben Shahar came up with an idea.
Dr. Ben Shahar. That sounds, you remember when Steve Martin used to make those movies that were just complete farce? Like later on, he got very sophisticated. But those first few movies, like The Jerk and so forth, he was just so farcical. That sounds like a Steve Martin bit. What's your name? Dr. Shahar.
Like, imagine him at a hotel desk. He rings the little bell. Ding, ding. Yes, can I help you? Yes, I believe you have a room waiting for Dr. Ben Shahar. Hello.
Yes, I've got you right here, Mr. Shahar.
No, it's Shahar.
Oh, I'm sorry. Shahar.
Nope. The emphasis is on Shahar.
Oh, no, I think I got it. Gugar.
Gugar. Yeah. No, that name absolutely sounds like that. So yes. Anyway, Dr. Ben Shahar came up with this idea, and he coins it arrival fallacy, the idea that it is a fake thought or a fake aspiration, that once you, quote unquote, make it, once you get to the goal that you have, that then all of your existing foibles or existing self-evaluations or existing self-accreditations of how you're good or bad or failing or succeeding, all of that will suddenly turn like a light switch on and you'll feel great about yourself and everything will be perfect after that, right? And I loved the idea of calling it arrival fantasy, because it's the idea of like, oh, Brad, once I move to New York, everything is great. I no longer live in Des Moines, and now I live in New York, and it's all wonderful. And then you move to New York, and first of all, you see a rat pulling a giant slice of pizza down the street, and you're like, what is happening?
This never happened in Des Moines.
Des Moines didn't have rats this big. And then second, you realize that you're still the same person that you were when you moved from Des Moines. You know, as I said before, the love has to come from inside of yourself, not from some external validation, not from some demarcation that says, now you have made it. So Brad, before we close that thought out, any thoughts from you on that? Because you and I have talked about this idea of arrival fallacy many times before.
It's something that is really, really important to keep in mind for all artists, because we all have those goals. And by the way, it's good to have goals, but it's bad to hang your self-worth on those goals, right? For years, I was, in fact, I've been thinking a lot about this, because they just announced the paper that I used to work for, the Philadelphia Daily News. They're gonna end it. They're just gonna kind of wrap it into the Inquirer. And I've been thinking a lot about my time at the Daily News. And those last several years, I was incensed. I was driven. I was single-minded in I wanted to build my comic so I could get out of that place. And it was my driving goal. And I needed to become a full-time cartoonist. I wanted to become a full-time cartoonist. And it was, and I had a ton of arrival fallacy wrapped up into what was going to happen when I finally became a full-time cartoonist. And obviously, without belaboring the point, none of it came to fruition. You know, people were not lined up at my doorstep waiting with opportunities. Like Dave said, I was the same guy I was yesterday, only I didn't have a paycheck coming in from the Daily News, and I had to figure out how to make that make up that loss.
Yeah,
you know, there was some real life things that happened, but all of those fantasies I had were just that. So yeah, goals are good. hanging your self-worth on those goals is a real problem.
And you know what, Brad? Something you said last week actually comes to mind here, which is that remembering to take a long view and an even keel in these moments.
Yeah, keep your eye on the horizon.
Yeah, on the horizon. That's exactly true. Because you had said last week when we were talking about how my most recent Kickstarter, I felt a little down because the one previous had been so much better, right? And you said, yeah. But what is the long view? Keep your eye on the horizon. And I've actually been thinking about that. I want to thank you, first of all, because I've internalized that. And thank you also because I've been thinking about it this week. And it kind of reminds me, and this is an imperfect example, but do you know that Chinese proverb of, and I'm going to pronounce it wrong, it's something like Sei Wang is his name, the Chinese proverb of Sei Wang?
Yeah,
all right, now I know you're about to be sarcastic, but...
no, he was roommates back in college with Dr. Shahar.
All right. No, so he was, I'm gonna tell this story because I always like it. It's a great story about maintaining an even keel in life, which is he raised horses, beautiful horses, right? And his most prized horse runs away. And his neighbor comes to him and goes, oh, I'm so sorry about the bad luck of your horse running away. And he goes, well, good luck, bad luck, who can say, right? And so a week goes by and his most prized beautiful horse runs back and brings with it a wild, beautiful horse. Then now he has two beautiful, amazing horses, right? And the neighbor goes, holy shit, now you have two amazing horses. This is what great luck. And he goes, well, good luck, bad luck, who can say? And so then his son tries to break the new horse and falls off and shatters his leg, right? The leg is just ruined. And the neighbor goes, oh, God, I'm Sei Wang, I'm so sorry. Your horse, your son, well, what bad luck. And he goes, good luck, bad luck, who can say? And so then a week later, the emperor announces a war and everyone's being conscripted and they come around to get his son and they go, oh, well, his leg's shattered. We can't take him. All right, he's past conscription. And the neighbor goes, oh, my God, he didn't get conscripted. This is amazing. And Sei Wang goes, good luck, bad luck, who can say? And I always like that proverb because it tells you that as your career progresses, like you've won an award, Brad Geiger, now you've made it. And you're like, well, we'll see. Let's take the long-term view. And then, Brad, your book didn't kickstart as well as you wanted. And you're like, well, let's take the long-term view. You know, that kind of thing. It's a parallel thought to like, just maintain an even keel, keep your head down, keep working. You're doing fine. Maintain a level of comfort with who you are and what you're able to do and keep your eye on the horizon, like Brad said. And I think that's good long-term advice.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as much as you wanted to make fun of me bringing up that proverb, I think that proverb was helpful, Brad Geiger.
You didn't tell the end of the story, though.
Okay,
went halfway. The end of the story is that the army comes and they say, well, we can't take the kid, but we got to take somebody from the family. End up taking the mother-in-law. The neighbor comes around and says, oh, I heard about your news. And Sei Wang says, yeah, what a stroke of luck.
God damn it. That is the most 1950s joke you've ever thrown out.
I had to come up with somebody.
You literally went with a mother-in-law joke. For God's sake. Why don't we just send you to the Catskills, Brad Geiger? The neighbor comes back and he goes, oh, they took your mother-in-law. Hey, whoa. Bada bing, bada boom. Take my wife, please. Like, Brad just got a violin tucked under his elbow.
Oh, God. I'm telling you, it's one of my true, my own faults. I love that old stuff. And I couldn't think of anything better than a mother-in-law in that moment.
What's great, though, I love this part as a friend. So I'm picturing you on the microphone, right? And I'm trying to share this Chinese proverb that I've always loved. And you're on the other end of the line, not listening at all, just going, what's the joke? 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 Think, think, think. Oh, mother-in-law, I got it. All right, now if this dummy will shut up, I'm ready to deliver my joke.
And I almost laid off the first time around, but then I'm like, no way, I'm going to go with it. I brought it back around and pulled that trigger.
Oh, that's delightful.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, the big picture, though, is that I just wanted to share that phrase because I think it's very helpful for encapsulating the idea of thinking that everything's going to be great when you do X, Y, Z. And so arrival fallacy from Dr. Ben Shahar. I thought was very... you do give it a more pirate twist. I like that. Arr, he be Dr. Ben Shahar.
Shahar, mateys.
Hello. Can you imagine him at a symposium and he's presenting his paper on arrival fallacy? Hello, I be Dr. Ben Shahar.
You can tell by my socks. They're Shahargiles.
Would someone hold my parrot while I deliver my paper? My treatise be only 30 pages long. It only will be taking an hour. I be Dr. Ben Shahar.
Shahar. Oh, my God. Right.
Now that we've driven the sword firmly through that one, let me ask you a $5 question, Brad. And this goes out to specifically Brad Geiger. This is one of our $5 Patreon questions when you join at patreon.com/comiclab. And Brad Geiger, this comes from Joshua Greathouse. And it says, Brad, how can Brad, quote, not suitable for work comic Geiger, be upset by public kissing? And actually, I would love to hear the answer by this. Brad, how can someone who draws what you draw be upset by public kissing?
I'll tell you why, because it's not me. So first of all, I mean, without throwing a complete wet blanket over that, I exaggerated a little bit of that to make it a little bit funny. But I will say this, and that is that there is a time and a place for everything. And one or two little smooches in public, I certainly don't get upset about. But these people were like every 5 minutes they were in a lip lock, and it did kind of catch my attention. But I do believe that there's a time and a place for everything. And I keep my not safe for work stuff in a certain time and a certain place. You don't see me spreading that all over. I don't share it in certain places. I don't talk about it in other places. I talk about it where it's appropriate for me to talk about that. And so if you really want an honest answer, it's that I do believe that there's a time and a place for things and a certain amount past which things start to be a bit much.
I love that even after decades, you can take the boy out of the Midwest, but you can't take the Midwest out of the boy.
This has nothing to do with Midwest. They were kissing every 10 minutes.
Do you think someone from New York or Los Angeles or Seattle would care about PDA? No. Only someone who grew up in Bad Axe Mission would be like, oh, gosh, I don't know about all. That's a lot of kissing in public. Oh, those people, I can see their tongues. Oh, this is not appropriate. Oh, gosh, I'm going to go over here back to the Dairy Queen and just sit down and with my head in my hands. This is terrible. Oh, gosh.
It is funny because what happens, I will call myself on this. I'll notice something like that. And then instead of saying, okay, this is annoying me, I'm going to turn my attention to something else that's unannoying to me. I focus on it even more. Like, it's like, oh my God, that is a tongue piercing, isn't it? You know, it's like, why are you even looking at their tongues? You just go back over here. Do something that doesn't annoy you. And then I come right back to it. It's almost like having a sore tooth. Have you ever had a toothache?
And your tongue goes right to it.
Every time, bink, bink, bink. That's me in a nutshell. When I see something like that, I hyper-focus on it to my own detriment because it becomes a distraction.
The way I'm picturing this in my mind now is that it's like a Monty Python camera pan. So imagine two 20-year-olds just going to town outside of a White Castle, right? Their hamburgers are uneaten, and they're just going to town on each other. And the camera slowly pans over to one table over, and Brad Geiger by himself with a fork and a knife in his hand straight up on the table is just staring at the couple, just like a cat looking at a dead fish, just unable to move away from looking.
Just seething with anger.
Yeah, but has the little napkin tucked into his shirt collar to make sure that he's got, you know, keeps a clean shirt, but just staring at the 20-year-olds going to town on each other.
Well, I wish I could tell you you're absolutely wrong.
Yeah, so do I.
But I can't.
You know what would be great from a psychological perspective? It would be great to get you on the couch and have Dr. Ben Shahar examine you for why you're opposed to PDA.
Well, tell me, Dr. Shahar, why is it that I can't stop looking at these people when they're doing PDA?
Brad, even though I was born on the coast of Wales, I agree with you that PDA has a time and a place. And that place be behind a Patreon paywall. It's not suitable for work comics.
Actually, I've got something you might want to try. I use it myself. It's a patch for one of your eyes. You just put the patch over the eye that's closest to the couple, and you won't be seeing a thing there, lad.
Arr, Brad, I've got a technique that's surefire to work. It's called looking away, you idiot.
Or limping away if you've got a peg.
That's right. Just a quick limp away. Well, anyway, I thought that was a funny question to throw at you. So we'll move on to the next one here. So, Brad, all right, the next question comes in from also from Joshua. How did Joshua get two questions this month? Wait a minute.
It's just the way I don't know. I didn't realize that we had done that.
Oh, you know what? We must not have answered his question last month, so it got bumped into this month. That happens every once in a while. Yeah. Well, Joshua, congratulations. You've gotten two questions on one show, breaking all the rules. Joshua Greathouse, right. Here we go. So here's the question, Brad. One of Japan's largest manga publishers, Shonen Jump, has been putting their comics online through an app. They have published some of the largest titles in the world, such as One Piece, Naruto, Dragon Ball Z. Oh, you remember Dragon Ball Z, don't you, Brad?
Oh, yeah. That's right. The home of all of the people having endless monologues out in an easy-to-draw desert before they do any fighting at all at the end of the show.
But didn't we have a run on, like, episode 2 of Comic Lab where you told me the name of the main Dragon Ball guy, and I was like, I went on a run for, like, 40 minutes on his name?
I think you're right. Yeah, Goku.
Goku, that's right, because remember I did the, look at all them Gokus. Oh, a lot of Gokus running around.
How could I forget?
Remember at Comic-Con, I think I even sent you a voicemail message like, oh, Brad, hey, I'm here at Comic-Con. A lot of Gokus running around. Look at all these Gokus.
Gokus around here. Sometimes they're hanging out with the Draculas.
I kept taking pictures with Gokus going, hey, Brad, look it, I found another Goku.
Okay, I remember. What do you want from me?
Sorry. That was more of a pat on the back for me. I just always like that Goku joke.
Yes,
anyway.
You're very funny, Dave. You're very funny. Right. Now, so read Joshua's question.
Thank you, Dr. Shahar. All right. So Shonen Jump has published One Piece, Naruto, Dragon Ball Z, and so on. Well, they offer the first three chapters for free and the last for free. To read the rest, you have to join their service, which is $2 a month. A pretty good deal since One Piece is 940 chapters long. And I'm sure this will come into my answer, so I wanted to emphasize that.
Yeah.
Here is my question. Do you think this system could work for independent people like us? I know Brad was talking about putting his older works behind a paywall. Do you think this could work for an ongoing title, or is this something that really only works from a system that in a system where people are used to paying $15 for a book, and this is now the cheapest way to support those creators? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Brad Geiger, international critic of comics, go. How do you think this works for Shonen Jump, and why would it or would not work for Evil Inc.?
I always get a little bit nervous when I see somebody taking a look at a business a strategy that a huge publisher with tons of stuff at their disposal, tons of capital, tons of resources, a lot of people that they can direct, and a lot more content than an independent can have, 940 chapters being a great indication of that. I get really nervous when somebody looks at that and says, could that work for an independent artist? Because it's really comparing apples and oranges. It makes me really nervous. It's not that it's impossible, but I get really nervous when we start going down that road, because it's like there's so much that's involved here, so many variables, and so much that's going to go into making something like that work, that it's not going to scale downwards to you. And me, for that matter. So do I think that could work? I think that there is value in putting some of your stuff behind a paywall and keeping some of it out front for free as a way to guide people in towards the paywall stuff. That much, I think, is valuable. As far as following their approach completely to the tune of $15 and stuff like that, I'm a little bit nervous about. I don't think I would go that far, but I think some of the general things that is talking about in terms of keeping some of it free and directing people in towards the paid stuff, whether you do it like the first two chapters or the last two chapters, or there'd be dozens of ways that you could do that. I think the basic kernel of idea behind that is something that you could definitely experiment with and probably do it successfully. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I think you're on the right path there, Brad. And so I'm going to co-sign what Brad just said.
Yeah.
I think that elements of what that is actually kind of what Brad does with Evil Inc. and Patreon.
Yeah.
And kind of what I do with Drive and Patreon, and kind of what we advised Jake Parker to do with Skyhard a couple weeks ago. Which is that you there's a public face that where you share some stuff, and then there's a private behind the paywall kind of thing where either things are seen in advance, things are shared that are only exclusive to Patreon, things are seen but with a twist or a commentary on it, et cetera, et cetera. And so, but I don't want you to set yourself up for an emotional or psychological failure where you go, well, Shonen Jump is able to do this. It's like, well, yeah, the mangaka system has 15 people cranking out one of those chapters every whatever week or month or whatever it is. And
right.
They've been going since 97 on One Piece or whatever it is, 98. I don't remember when One Piece started, but something like that, late 90s. And then I think the Gokus have been going for even longer than that, right? Or am I mistaken?
Most definitely. I think you're right, yeah.
Yeah, so first of all, they have an archive that goes back to Kingdom Come. And second of all, they now have a staff of God knows how many cranking those things out every week. And so if Brad had a staff of six working on Evil Inc., I could guarantee there would be a new half page of Evil Inc., probably a new page of Evil Inc. every day, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Ready, colored, ready to share on Patreon, that kind of thing. So what I'm getting at is don't compare. This is a version of don't compare someone else's highlight reel to your failures, but don't compare the success of a major corporation coming out of one of the most successful comics publishing markets in the world to your minuscule efforts and feel like a failure in exchange, you know? But to Brad's point, take what you can from their model and incorporate it into your Patreon system or something like that. And so, and you know, we always talk about Patreon. There are ways to do what Shonen Jump is doing with maybe a PayPal system or maybe with an occasional Kickstarter. It's a little more complicated, but I want you to know that we're not just always focused on Patreon. It's just that Patreon is the best custom suited thing to do something like this. Wouldn't you say, Brad?
Oh, absolutely. I'm unapologetic about it. Patreon is...
You're unapologetic? Is that...
I am unapologetic. Other words, yeah, sure, you could do that through PayPal. You'd be doing 10 times as much effort and you wouldn't be locked in and baked into a whole lot of the stuff that Patreon offers. I'm unapologetic in endorsing Patreon for this. They are the best at doing this sort of thing, hands down. And they've got the best network set up for this. So yeah, I'm a strong Patreon guy. If you want to try something else, that's fine. But I make no apologies in endorsing Patreon.
Yeah. So, but to put a capstone on this, though, I think the core idea of what Shonen Jump is able to do with releasing snippets to the public let's look at the basic of what they do. They're enticing you. They're giving you. They're basically a drug dealer. They're giving you just enough to get you hooked, and then they're making you pay for the rest. Right. So here's the big opening number. The first three chapters. Ooh, here's the stunning conclusion. The last chapter. You want to know how we got through all of that? Well, here you got to pay for the 150 chapters in the middle, that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And it's smart. It's a smart way to do it. So for you as a cartoonist, you could release the first 5 to 10 to 15 pages of a story. And by the way, I think, Brad, I'm going to do a version of this on my next Kickstarter. I think going to make the first 10 to 15 pages of the book publicly available as a PDF so you can get a sense of what it's going to look like. What are your thoughts on that? I actually haven't brought this up to you. Give me the pluses and minuses of that.
I like that idea a lot. In fact, the only thing that we've talked about today that I'm not crazy about is like making the last entire chapter available. I could see
I don't particularly love that
a variation of that. I could see making some live pages available as you're doing them. And then maybe once that chapter is complete, then poof, it disappears and goes behind the paywall. So if you've been following along, you could see it. But once that's a readable unit, then it goes behind the paywall. But on the other end of that, making those first several pages or the entire first chapter available, absolutely. I think that's a really smart idea.
Yeah. So I have to say, though, Brad, showing the end chapter, there is a type of personality that likes to glance at the back of the book to see where things are. Like, do I want to invest my time in this? You know what I mean? I will admit that at times I have been that person that flips to the back of a book before I buy it. In fact, I remember in college, I flipped to the back of, what was it, Brothers Karamazov and read the last 20 pages. And I was like, oh, what a boring ending. And then I looked at it like it was 600 pages or whatever. And I remember thinking, I got to plod through all this to get to that boring ending. God damn it. All right. Why did I read the end? And it can be hit or miss in terms of reading the end. But go ahead. You had a counter thought. Go ahead. What was it? What was yours?
You've got, for every person that reads the end of the book, you've got somebody that doesn't want to know how it ends. And if they read that, they would consider it a spoiler. And they would say, why am I reading this book now? I know how it ends.
Sure. But you'd have to admit that that reader was pretty dumb if it literally says, last chapter. And they go, oh, I'm going to read this.
Spoiler. Who could have seen that coming? I never thought. No one ever told me it was the last chapter. Well, I guess it does say last chapter on the front.
It depends on how you presented it. That's true. You'd have to do an awful lot of outreach. You'd have to do some very careful design to make sure that because remember, you're also talking, the whole idea of doing this is to snare this person that's coming to your site or coming across your work for the very first time, right? That's what you're doing on your site. And you'd have to do very careful outreach on that to make sure
let me switch back to my idea, because I would love to get some feedback from you. What do you think about sharing the first 10 or 15 pages for free on Gumroad?
Without a doubt, I'm for it. I'm super for it. In fact, I would share it in every venue, every opportunity I could get when you're doing that Kickstarter. That's your promotion.
The only reason why I mentioned Gumroad is that if I share it via my Dropbox, eventually my data limitations will kick in, my caps. But if I share it on Gumroad, there's no data limitations, and you can create a code that drops the price down to zero for an item, and then unlimited number of people can download it for free using that code. So it's free to share a PDF on Gumroad or an ebook.
Well, and also just being a little bit Machiavellian, the brilliant thing about doing that is that once that happens, you have a built-in mailing list that you can send out a promotion to everybody that downloaded it saying the new drive is up or the new book is out or the new download is available.
You magnificent SOB. I never thought about that.
Yeah, you're building a mailing list for future reference.
You're so smart. What a nice, handsome person you are.
What a nice judge of handsome you are. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute and stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, Brad and I are going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
Yeah, because, you know, when you do, you'll get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And an exclusive Patreon post that go even deeper on the Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, no worries.
You can still support the show by rating us wherever you get podcasts.
Leave us a 5-star review and a few kind words.
And that, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
And now, let's talk comics. Oh, nice. I like a little read-in music. So let's go on to our next fun contestant here on Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics. This one's coming from Kelly. Kelly writes, in Brad's recent live stream, he mentioned using a brush which made inking things like straps easier. My question is, are there tools you found to make things easier in your process? This can include brushes used on special effects or word balloons. Thank you so much. I really enjoy the podcast. And this actually, by the way, Dave, dovetails nicely with a similar question we got from Stephen Crawford, who says, I'd like to know more about the tools you use to draw your comics. So, Dave Kellett, I ask you, what tool are you using?
Can I tell you, I'm going to put on Spanish Flea more often because your voice became delightful. There was one point where you became kind of readerly. You're like, my question is, are there tools? But then Spanish Flea like kicked back into a big like kind of a chorus. And you were like, oh, are there tools you found that you could? And it was great. I really enjoyed that.
That song does have a tendency to kind of get into your head there. It kind of changes a person.
I haven't used it in a while, but we do have the ability to put in little audio notes. Like, remember Orson Welles, Brad?
Ah, mother.
How could I forget?
Yeah, so anyway, I don't want to become a hacky morning radio DJ, but there you go. All right, so Stephen also answered his finished his question, Brad, by saying, what innovations have you seen over your career that have helped you tool-wise? So
yeah,
let's talk about tools for a minute. So Brad, do you want to go first? I'll go first since you asked the question.
Yeah, so you go first.
I draw my two comics in two entirely different ways. Drive, I draw digitally in Photoshop on a 24-inch, I think, it's the new Pro 24 Cintiq Wacom, or Wacom Cintiq, sorry, which is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then I can take you through that process. But let me take you first through the analog process for Sheldon, because I think that one is a little bit more unique. So mm-hmm. what I do with Sheldon is I still produce finished original art, right, Brad? So it's ink on paper. Yes. I still enjoy that process, and I still enjoy selling the originals as part of that process. So what I do there is I used to pencil my comic and then have to erase with either an electric eraser or with one of those giant Japanese triangle erasers that fit mm-hmm. really nicely in the palm of your hand. Which, by the way, I also recommend. If you're there, I've only ever found them at Comic-Con at the Copic booth. They are giant plastic Japanese erasers that are the shape of about a 3-inch triangle, and they are amazing to hold, and they work so well because they always have a tip. Anyway, so look for those when you're at a Comic-Con at the Copic booth. But what was I going to say? Oh, so Sheldon, I used to pencil it, but now I digitally pencil it on the Wacom. And mm-hmm. It makes it so much easier because, Brad, now I can resize Sheldon's, move things around, flip the duck around, change the background, move the background on a different layer and nudge it this way or that. And it's not constant erasing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's so much easier there. And then I print that out on an 11x17 piece of paper on an Epson. And then I bring that physically over to my desktop, and then I put it on a light box. And a light box, for those of you that don't, everybody knows what a light box is. I light box it. And then on top of that, I have Bristol vellum paper, 11x14, that I cut in half so that it's 5 inches by 14 inches, the size of a comic strip. And then what I do is I line up the paper, tape it down to one another at the corners, and I use two main pens. The first one that I use is a Pigma Micron. And the reason I use that is it's an archival ink, meaning it lasts 80, 90 to 100 years under light. It's both light fast and archival, mm-hmm. Which is important to me because I sell the original art. Yeah. And then for thicker lines, and I'll use either a 05 or 08, sometimes 03, 04 for lettering. And then for thicker lines and more artistic brusherly lines, I will use a Faber-Castell pit pen, the B tip, which is the brush-like tip. It's not a brush. It's actually like a plasticky foam that they cut in the shape of a brush, but it's brush-esque, if you know what I mean, Brad. It's mm-hmm. It has a little bit more give than some other pens, and so I like it in that it's brush-esque while still maintaining a clean look. And then occasionally, I'm reaching over to physically grab it. Occasionally, if it's something very organic, like a tree or a river in the background, I will go a little Bill Watterson style, and I will grab a Series 7 Winsor & Newton sable brush, and they're very hard to come by in the U.S. anymore because they've outlawed sable brushes, but you can find simulacrums if you ask at an art store, say, what do you have that mimics sable? They'll guide you to it. But like Charles Schultz with his quills, I stocked up on sable when I saw that they were about to be outlawed. So I have a bunch in my desk. But a Series 7 is a really nice tip, not too big, not too small. And then I dip that in FW acrylic artist ink. And I make a tree or a river or a rock or something organic. A brush is really good for something organic.
Mm-hmm.
And then, just because we're talking about pens, I might as well share this. The Kuretake Reservoir brush pen that you can fill up with any type of ink that you like, that's also very handy for organics. And then, if you're sketching in a sketchbook and you don't necessarily care about archivalness or ink or light-fast quality, the Pentel brush pen, which is a cartridge that you can insert into a brush pen, is also great. Carl Kerschel introduced me to this one, and I love it because it has both a good wet brush look and a dry brush look as it starts to dry out. It has a great dry brush feel. And what's nice is this is an actual brush that has the feel of a pen. And then the other one that I was just going to mention is there's a fantastic book, a pen that Danielle Corsetto turned me on to for Comic-Cons for signing. When you're doing a lot of signing, both signing a lot of books to mail out or doing a lot of signing at a Comic-Con, And that's a stylo, S-T-Y-L-O pen that has kind of a faux quill. It's like a plasticky kind of a thing that it looks like a quill, looks and acts like a quill. And it puts down ink great. It's very quick. It's easy on your hand and your wrist, so you don't have cramping after 3 or 4 days of Comic-Con when you're doing a lot of signing. And that's those are my pen recommendations, right? But now I've been talking too long. Why don't you take me through your digital process, Brad, because I would love to hear about that.
Yeah, because that's what I like about this question is that we can both take it from either side, because I've long since stopped doing all pen and ink and pencil work, and I'm completely digital now. And just as an aside, you mentioned 24 inch. That when I was over at your studio, that Wacom that I was using, that was 24 inches.
Yeah, it has that new glass on the cover that's gorgeous.
Oh, in my studio here and at home, I've got a couple of 12WXs, which are incredible workhorses, and I love them. But I've got to say how absolutely luxurious it was to work on a 24-inch. That's literally twice the size of mine. No wonder it felt so big. It actually almost felt like, what am I going to do with all this space, you know?
Yeah, but sometimes when you're working with, when you need a big brushstroke to capture, like you want to use a major muscle group rather than a minor muscle group, like you want to draw from your elbow rather than drawing from your wrist. It's really handy for that. But as you know from the past, I have both a Cintiq Companion and an old 21UX, and those are perfectly fine too. So the 24 inch is just it's a luxury. You don't have to go that big, but it's nice when you have it.
God, it's gorgeous. Well, I just had to mention that because it was fun doing that. But my process is digital, and I'm specifically using Clip Studio Pro for my illustration, not necessarily Photoshop. And there are some brushes. I'll start with the one that Kelly mentioned from my live stream. I use a double outline brush. So what this is when you make a mark, it has basically you're making two black lines, and you have a choice. You can even either fill the middle with white, or you can leave the middle transparent. So if you're drawing, for example, a garden hose or a snake or somebody's tail or straps on a strappy outfit like gowns or strappy shoes, these or shoelaces for that matter. These are perfect because you make a perfect double outline. You know, the problem with a snake is that you've got to keep those two lines perfectly parallel to each other, even through the curves. Otherwise, the snake looks like he's been eating a mouse or something or been stepped on by a shoe because the lines go in and out and you end up with a really awkward looking snake. I can do it using this double outline brush with one stroke. Zoop. And it's beautiful and gorgeous and pretty darned accurate for what I want it to be. And I will happily give the person a little endorsement. You can get one just like the one I use at gumroad.com/RonDanChan. That's Ron, R-O-N, Dan, D-A-N, Chan, C-H-A-N, all together, Ron Dan Chan. And they sell a double outline brush for peanuts, and you'll use it constantly in Clip Studio. So that's the first one. Also, probably the same as you, Dave, and I know this is something this person makes brushes for both Clip Studio and Photoshop, and that is the Frendon brush package for inking and penciling. Do you use Frendon brushes?
Well, I got to tell you, Brad, I fell in love with Kyle Webster, who designs a ton of brushes for Photoshop, a whole catalog, to the point where Beth and I made a whole flip book. I think I showed it to you once.
Yeah.
Of like, so that you could flip through and physically see what all the brushes create rather than having to scroll down. Because one thing that Adobe does terribly is that it doesn't let you search for brushes by name, and it doesn't let you have a big, nice visual for each brush if you hover over the name or something. There are ways that could have done it better, and Adobe didn't do it that way. Anyway, Adobe has since hired Kyle Webster to work in-house. So now when you're on Creative Studio or CC, Creative Cloud, you get all those brushes included now in Photoshop. So I use all those ones in the new CC Photoshop.
I like it. That's a good one that I didn't know.
I can look for Patreon backers on the blog when this goes up. I can share the ones that I use, the four or five Kyle Webster brushes that I love. But he's got everything from Kirby to dry brush to manga to speed lines to old 1950s newspaper looks, brushes. It's great. He's got the whole package. And I'm sure it's a version of what you found with Frendon, is that the people that once you've cracked the nut on how to create a Photoshop brush, it's kind of fun, I'm sure, for them to just go nuts and start creating all sorts of things.
Yeah. And Frendon, just to put a cap on it, you can find those brushes at Frendon.com, F-R-E-N-D-E-N.
So that's not spelled Dr. Shahar. That's not the...
that's not spelled with a C. It's not spelled with an S-H and then a long A-R-R-R-R-R-R.
Yeah, exactly.
And last thing, I'm really a big fan of working in Clip Studio for this very reason. Sometimes I'll be to a point where I want to build a texture, or I want to have a line that's in a certain way. And instead of searching all over, like at all of these third-party sites, if you open your materials palette in Clip Studio and click at the top where it says search for additional materials, you'll see that there's a whole host of textures and brushes and backgrounds and patterns just waiting for you to download directly into your software and use, and most of them are free. They go by some like a gold point or gold coin thing. You can't put actual money in, but you can buy gold points that you can then use like money. I think that's some kind of a transaction workaround. But most of the stuff, in fact, I've never had to actually pay for anything that I use there. Most of it is free, and you get some spectacular textures like fur and just to talk about, you know, you get out a brush to use a tree. I showed you this while I was at your studio. They've got one brush that literally is a tree, and it you do one swipe and you end up with tree with bark and texture and little nodules and stuff. It's jaw dropping that you did that with one stroke. But there's a brush that I use for tree bark all the time. And that's just something I downloaded from Clip Studio. So that's another reason I'm a big CSP fan.
Well, can I tell you, Brad, while you were talking, I looked up Ron Chan's double brush outline for CSP.
Yeah.
And first of all, that is brilliant. Good on Ron for creating that. That's amazing. And the fact that he's charging nothing for it. So please donate to Ron if you download that brush, because I'm sure he spent time crafting that and building that. But if anybody knows if that exists for Photoshop anywhere, oh boy, let me tell you, there's a little cartoonist in Los Angeles that would love to use that brush. So if anyone knows...
Now, wait a minute. Haven't you switched to Clip Studio yet? After I spent that afternoon showing you all of the best of Clip Studio, I wasn't able to just swing you right over.
God no, that thing is still. No. I continue to try Clip Studio Pro, and it confuses the hell out of me. I don't understand that program.
I've got to spend a week where we're doing nothing but working in the studio together. We should have started that earlier.
I, honest to God, need you to go through an entire drive with me. Like, here's how you would sketch it. Here's how you would lay out the text. Here's how you would do the bubbles. I don't understand that program. The interface, I know this makes me sound like the oldest man alive, but that interface is so confusing to me. And the fact that every layer is its own, potentially a vector, potentially a raster, potentially something else. What is it? You'll never know. Like, I don't understand that program. And it's, I admit to the world that I'm an idiot, that I can't figure it out. So I know Photoshop. I know how to work it. I'm literally like, I've become the syndicated cartoonist we used to make fun of. That's like, no, I'm not changing. I don't understand this new world. It scares me.
All right. Next time we're going to clear out a couple of days just to do, we'll do a tandem together. I'll just stand right by your desk there and point over your shoulder.
Well, here's the thing, though, Brad, too, is that I think I told you once, I reached out to the Clip Studio Pro company and I said, do you have someone that I could hire to teach me this program? I actively want to learn it, and I will pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars to have someone teach it to me. And they said, oh, no, but we've got a lot of YouTube videos. I was like, I don't want to listen to a 4-hour YouTube video to learn how to do the one part of the process. And then I needed to learn to listen to 40 other YouTube videos to learn the other 40 parts of my process. You know what I mean? Like, there is no more inefficient way to learn than a YouTube video, I feel like.
This is me every time I try to watch a YouTube tutorial. Click. Hey, everybody, it's me. I'm here with another tutorial. Don't forget to like my page and subscribe to my... Click. That's about as far as I get.
Yeah.
Before I have to, I've got to turn it off and it's just shut up and tell me what you're going to show me. But
it's,
instead,
it's the worst because it's always like some
lead in.
It's always some young dude going, hey, don't forget to smash like and subscribe. Oh, man. We've been learning so many great trips here on Bobby Z's Clip Studio Pro Studio Fun YouTube tips. Oh, boy. And I'm like, just get to the GD point. Teach me how to change the brush size. And I'm like, oh, boy. Don't forget. Oh, and remember, check out next week's video. Just like, and you're just skipping ahead 30 seconds. Like, nope, still talking.
Yeah.
It's like the people that share cooking recipes online, but the first three paragraphs are like talking about their grandmother's loving, you know, way that they used to make bread. You're like, just get to the recipe. Come on, for the love of God.
Yeah. I've got the flour sifted. I'm waiting here. And for any 10-minute tutorial, the part that you need is about a minute and a half in the middle. You just have to find that middle.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly. So anyway, me trying to learn Clip Studio Pro by YouTube videos, if I was a kid and didn't have stuff to do and I could fill my summer just watching YouTube videos, no, I'm not being insincere. I'm saying like, no, that's intended for. You know?
Yeah.
Like, but if you're a pro and you want to say, like, I need someone to teach me these exact, I know what I need. I need these 35 things taught to me. I have $500 to $1,000 here. Send me an artist that can teach it to me. And the Clip Studio Pro is like, we've got more YouTube videos. I'm like, fuck off. I just want to hire somebody. Why don't you offer that? Anyway. That's me being so grumpy and like, I actively want to learn that program, and it is so tricky to. I don't know. I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated by it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm right there with you. I totally understand. Like I said, when I was in Los Angeles, I just made the decision that I was going to flip the switch, and I spent the first weekend in utter hell trying to, you know, find my way through. But I was just bullheaded. And the first couple strips probably had some flaws in them. And then I just worked my way out of it. But if that was also, I was a little bit younger and had a little bit more flexible time. If I were to do that today, I don't know that I'd make it. You know, that's it. I totally get where you're coming from.
Well, and here's my big concern, Brad, with switching from Photoshop to CSP. And lest I sound like a complete Luddite, what I'm trying to avoid is I don't want to have created 30 pages of Drive before I realize I did it wrong in CSP. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like my time and the amount of time that I spend on a Drive page can sometimes be 2 or 3 days. I know that doesn't seem to other people, but I'm not fast. And so if I've somehow had some tiny little setting checked wrong or you know, somehow save the file wrong in CSP or somehow did vector or raster wrong or something where I don't output it and it's not a 600 DPI line art file and a 300 DPI color file, whatever I have done wrong, and it produces a shitty book, I will hate myself that I made the switch over to CSP from Photoshop, you know?
That is something I totally get.
So I just want a pro level tutorial that says, and I don't want to sit through some kid teaching me how to make a BAM Zoom font. I don't care.
Yeah,
I just want to know the 40 things that I need to know to make a Drive and shut up about all the other stuff. And I know that I sound so grumpy right now. Wow.
No,
I'm kind of checking myself because I sound so grumpy.
I'm enjoying this, but you don't want a tutorial. You want a tutor.
Yes, that's I've called the company and I've approached them in person at Comic-Con saying, I want to hire somebody. Who do you have either in staff or as a third party that you would recommend? Oh, we have YouTube videos. I was like, God, that's not what I'm asking. This is anyway.
Actually, I've got an idea. I'm going to do a little bit of work in the background here and see if I can't make something happen in the meantime. But before we do that, let's go on to our next Patreon $5 question. I think we've got time for about one more. What do you think?
Yeah, before Grandpa busts a vein in his forehead here on my end.
So usually this is me. It's so fun to be on the other end of this. Now I see how why you enjoy recording this show so much.
Can I tell you, though? I don't enjoy being grumpy. Like, I get mad at myself for having been grumpy. I'm like, oh, darn it. Just keep it in check. Why you got to go that route?
Ah, come on. Join me on the dark side.
All right, next question. Let's do it.
This question comes from our good friend and Patreon backer, George Mackay, who says, any tips on writing good copy for a Patreon overview page? In other words, that first Patreon page, that opening body copy that you see that says, hey, I'm on Patreon and here's why. George says, I've read through the Patreon guidelines and implemented them as best as I can. I just was wondering if you had any further ideas. So, Dave Kellett, that opening body page for Patreon, some tips on your approach to writing something that's good there.
Okay, so this is in many respects a personal decision. So I want you to avoid corporate type language. This is Brad Geiger, the artist, not Brad Geiger pretending to be some company representing Brad Geiger. You know what I mean? So whatever that means for your style of writing, make it personal. This is a appeal of like, hey, you like my work and want to support it? That's amazing. And then also, remember that much like our discussion about t-shirts, Brad, and remember our discussion where we said, don't put your comic logo on a t-shirt and expect people to buy it. No one wants to wear your logo. That's you hoping they want to wear your logo. What they want is a shirt that communicates who they are, right? So we've talked about that in the past. And in a way, you want to make Patreon, they've already come to your page, so they've clearly expressed a tiny percent of interest in backing you. Now, the point of that page is to say, here are the things you will get when you back me on Patreon. You know?
Yes.
Don't make it like a t-shirt that's about you. Make it a t-shirt that's about them. So here's what you want to give, like your top three reasons to become a backer. And in fact, I'm just about to implement this in a revised form on my Patreon page is like, you'll get bang, bang, bang. Here are the three things you will get when you become a backer. And then you maybe even want to share a teaser post, something that would normally only be for patron only. But in this case, it's going to go public because you're going to share what that teaser kind of post would look like. And then something that I also haven't implemented, but Patreon recommends, is one or two, maybe two or three blurbs from patrons about why they back and why they continue to back and what they get out of it. Because what that does is it's a version of an Amazon review down below a product where you're like, I like the barbecue, but it doesn't get hot enough and my hot dogs don't cook so good. And that kind of human review lets you know like, oh, okay, I could see why they might review it that way. I am going to avoid buying it. Or okay, I see why they would review it that way. I would like a barbecue that doesn't cook very hot. So whatever it is for you, you know, but that kind of human touch of allowing in patron blurbs. And then a thing that is also great that Brad and I have done is implementing a thank you system. I just want to mention when someone joins up because they have made a personal decision to back Brad Geiger. So send them an email, send them a bonjoro, which is B-O-N-J-O-R-O. Send them a thank you in some way, shape, or form that says, hey, Brad, this is me, Dave Kellett. Thank you for backing Drive. I really appreciate it because they are backing you as a person. So thank them as a person. Those are just some top line ideas, Brad. But let's drill down more specifically, I guess, to that blurb. What would you write, Brad, in that blurb?
Well, I'm going to circle around back and I'm going to super underline something that you said, and that is to make it about them and not it about you. In other words, what's in it for them when they become a Patreon backer? And you can go through Patreon pages and see people making this mistake over and over again, because what the artist does is they say, if you become a Patreon backer, then I can do this, or I can buy this new equipment, or I can have more time to work, or I can get better supplies. The artist spends all this time saying what's in it for the artist. If you become a backer, I can add this and I can add that and I can add this. That's really a horrible way to go about this. You don't want to say what's in it for you. You want to say what's in it for me. That remember, they're putting money down. They're giving you some money. And no matter how much you think that they're doing this through altruistic reasons, and we're going to come around to that in a minute, or for any other reasons, people want to get things for their money. And Patreon is no different. What you need to make clear is what are they going to get for their money? It's not about you. It's not about what you can do. Yeah, that's nice to set as a milestone goal to say, if we hit this goal together, I can buy a new microphone. That's fine. But in your body, in where you're making your central pitch on Patreon, you need to say what's in it for them. So that's got to be forefront in your mind. Also, I would be very, very careful about the language you use. I would make it more like a transaction, for my taste, more like a transaction, less like a charity. I'd be very careful about using charity words. Support is okay. support is all right. But if you go too far and make this like a charity, you're going to set up a really awkward situation between you and that new patron who's going to treat you like a charity case.
So, Brad, can you give some sample charity words or dialogue or text that you think might be best avoided?
Yeah. For example, I wouldn't call it necessarily a donation. In fact, when I talk about this, I will talk about your pledge. I will talk about being a backer. I don't necessarily talk about it as a donation because it's not a donation. Again, they're getting something for their money. And if you parse this as a donation, then there's a completely different psychological framework being set up. And what you really need to make clear to these people is that they are getting something for their money. And as a result, you are doing better as an artist. That's why I give words like support a little bit of a leeway, because that's an open-ended word. But donation, help, assistance, stuff like that, words that you would find in a charity sense, I try to dial that back a little bit and put the focus more on the transaction, more on if you back me at this level, you get XYZ. Set up that transaction, because really that's what's on the mind of the person with their finger hovering over the button. What's in it for me? What am I going to get?
Yeah. Right? I think you're right, because it's also donation. The idea of a charity or donation words coming in, it just sets up a form of pity, which is not what this is. You know what I mean? This is a professional. You constantly want to not remind, but operate from the realm of like, I am giving you artwork, story, entertainment, a value in your life that you clearly are turning to. So, and in addition, when you back it, you will also get these other values that you will cherish. So make it a value proposition, not a charity proposition. A charity proposition is, I can't do it for myself, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas that changes the mood and tone of the whole relationship. Whereas these are readers, these are supporters, these are people that actively get value out of what you want to do. So you want to reinforce that by using value statements, and also by increasing what they get when they become backers. I think that Brad is dead on with that. I think that's a great idea, Brad.
And here's a couple more thoughts. Here's one, and that is, you need to project a friendly, joyful, happy tone. This is no place to be sour. This is no place to. I saw somebody that was that actually put something on a Patreon page that was all along the lines of, "I've got this $10 level where you get an exclusive comic." But and this was on his page. He goes, "I'm not even going to start doing the comic until I get at least 10 people at this level, because it's not worth it to me until that happens." And I read that, and I'm like, "Did you just write that?" In fact, my exact advice to him was, take the keyboard that you use to write that, unplug it from your computer, take it out back of your house, shoot the keyboard, bury it, come back in and try it again. You want to project joy. What you want to project is, I love doing this thing. And from you being involved as a Patreon backer, this thing can grow, and this thing can we can set up a situation so that I do more things and you get cool stuff. You want to project that joy of, I love doing this. People respond to joy.
Right.
That's what makes Instagram go round. People are posting things that make them joyful, whether it's a sketch or the slice of pie that they're about to eat. We absolutely respond to joyfulness, and putting forth this sour attitude or an attitude that is too clinical and too cut and dry can be trouble too. And the last part I want to say is, for the love of God, make it visual. There's so many cartoonists. You look at their Patreon page and it's just a block of gray type. And it's like, don't you understand what you are? The whole thing about being a cartoonist is mixing words and images to communicate. Your Patreon page, that central page, should have lots and lots of images. It should have sample comics. It should have examples of the rewards. It should have tons of images. It should, in fact, it should be maybe more image than text, and especially if those images do some word balloon communication as well. It should be fun and easy to read. And the last thing that I'm going to point out, I'm going to steal a pro tip from Josh Hanno from the Discord server. He had like an interview with some Patreon specialists. You know what they're suggesting currently? The new thing that they're suggesting? This blew my mind.
What's that?
Animated reward tier images.
Oh.
So you know how you've got like last year we were telling people, hey, if you don't have images over your reward tiers, the analytics that Patreon is using says that you're getting overlooked. So we were really pressing people to make images for their reward tiers. And I saw firsthand, super effective. What they're saying now is, and it doesn't have to be super animated, but maybe give it a little sparkle, give it maybe a real simple kind of motion. But they're saying that animation over there on those reward tier images are super effective.
Interesting.
And that came from Josh Hanno over in the Discord server of Comic Lab.
So thank you. That's a great one. I had not heard that.
Yeah,
Brad, that's something we should probably revisit for the old Comic Lab Patreon page. Actually,
I am definitely going to be revisiting for my own.
Time to remind myself how to make an animated GIF. Haven't done that in a while. All right, time to do that.
No kidding.
that's one of those settings in Photoshop that I'm like, all right, I did this last 3 years ago. How do I make an animated GIF? All right, so I click on the timeline.
It's funny. You used to do it every 2 months when you were on KeenSpot because you'd have to make one of those little banners that would go in the KeenSpot spotlight. Mm-hmm. And of course, animated banners worked super effective back then. And so every 2 months, You'd do a little animated GIF in Photoshop and you remembered how to do it, but I haven't been on KeenSpot for years and years and years, and I've completely forgotten how to do it.
Well, so this has raised two thoughts. One, what's old is new again. It's funny to hear that animated GIFs can be helpful in terms of attracting patrons.
Yeah.
But it makes sense because for the same reason that a restaurant, a sandwich shop hires a guy dressed up like a sandwich with a sign, movement attracts the eye and movement is enticing. So I can see why that would work. But secondly, Brad, this conversation in general, and I want to comment from a point of humility, this is reminding me that I need to revise my own Patreon pages, of which I have three, one for Sheldon, one for Drive, one for Comic Lab. And that's just a good note for all of us that every 6 to 18 months, maybe take another look at it and see if it's still working, what's new on Patreon that could be incorporated into your page, and see what best practices are operating out there. And Brad had mentioned this at the beginning, and I think I will re-echo it. It is worth it in any situation to look at what the real successes on a platform are doing. So in this case, look not only at comics, not only at like Zach Wiener-Smith or Jeff Jacks or Sarah Anderson or any of those people, but also take a look at the broader network of Patreon. See what podcasts are doing. See what painters are doing. See what sculptors are doing, because there may be an idea that you can apply. And is that a lot of work? Actually, no, not really. It only takes 20, 25 minutes to look at 40 different pages and see what their best practices are. And you'll get a sense of like, oh, I see they all have images in their reward tiers. Oh, I see the more successful ones have animated images in their reward tiers. Okay. And so that's the kind of research that's great, and it's both motivating and inspirational. And I would highly recommend it.
Yeah. And also, just to put a button on that, you mentioned Adobe Creative Cloud. I always kind of grind my teeth when when I get charged for that every month. But, you know, this is why I continue the subscription to Creative Cloud, because I know that if I go looking in their apps, they've more than likely have an app that'll do a quick and easy animation to a static image. And in fact, I think I've already seen it in the past. I can download that app just for this thing that just came up, and use it for free, or at least as part of my subscription. And I would have never had the ability to do that before.
Right.
So as much as CSS kind of or Creative Cloud kind of grinds me from time to time, I love knowing that I've got a little project, all of a sudden I've got to do some animation. Yeah, I bet you Adobe has an app for that and it's going to make it easy to do. So
yeah.
I will give them their credit where the credit is due.
There. Yeah, I mean, I come at a slightly more cynical angle from Photoshop and their pricing strategy, but so I'm a little bit more hateful of the fact that you can't do the buy it once and then you own it software anymore.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate that I can also uninstall and reinstall something like InDesign, which I only use twice a year to lay out a book. and then I can get rid of it for a while and then very quickly reinstall it again. And so I do appreciate aspects of Creative Cloud, even though I super grind my teeth about their pricing and sales strategies now. Anyway, so yeah, I agree with you, Brad. I do need to take a second and look at some of the lesser programs to see what could be helpful in making something like an animated GIF.
Absolutely. And on that note, you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been Brad Shahar, the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And a rare appearance by grumpy old Dave Kellett, my good friend and co-director of Stripped, and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode, as all episodes, was edited by the wonderful Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab.
Do you think when Dr. Shahar goes home, he's like, "Where are all me little Shahars?"
Oh, you touched me right in my Shahart.
God bless America.